Welcome to Let's Talk Land, a weekly land education talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, ownership, and especially for real estate agents and realtors. Learn from the experts, free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I am an accredited land consultant, broker owner of United Country Real Estate, Land Pro, buying or selling homes, land or farms in Western Piedmont, North Carolina, or Southern Virginia. Just give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our office is at 3349 Cook School Road in Pilot Mountain, North Carolina, off of Highway 52, exit 136, across from Foothills Hardware and Building Supply. We share office space with Freedom Designs and Marketing for all your graphic needs. Our company website is www.mylandpro.com. Just a program note. Dr. Barbie's Ask the Doctor show will now follow this show and will air at 10 a.m. after this show. So appreciate you listening to mine, but make sure you make the adjustment because Dr. Barbie used to be on in this time slot. So make that note. Our guest today is John Dean. Welcome, John.
Welcome.
John is an accredited land consultant like myself. We're both members of the Realtors Land Institute. We're the land folks of the National Association of Realtors with about a little over 1,300 members. And last count, maybe last month or before, I think there's about 518 of us that carry the ALC designation, which I know that you and I are both proud of that, John.
Well, we certainly are. We've both been ALCs for quite a while, Lou, as you probably know, and it's probably been probably one of the best inputs that I could have imagined in moving my career forward.
Absolutely, you know, they always say, and it's proven statistics in our industry, is the more education you have, usually the more money you make. It seems to work that way, and of course, I've got quite a bit like you invested in our organization, but I get so much out of it. We've got our annual land conference coming up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, here pretty soon, March 2nd, I think, through the 6th. And you'll be there, and I'll be there with all of our land men and land ladies from around the country and actually outside the country. Hope to learn a lot more of what's going on and help us bring that back and even make more money. It's what it's all about, right?
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to it. I try to make most of them, and as I possibly can. And you know, it's one of these things that's about the people and about the contacts and about the getting together with the best in the business and learning from them and sharing opportunities. And it's just one of those things you got to do.
Well, we are a family, and it's a little different than the residential realtors. Which is usually about 98% of our industry. It's just a special group of people, and we all help each other. I don't care what the situation is. I know over the years I've called you, different people from around the country. I've been called, what about this issue, or how do I do this, or can you recommend an attorney, or, you know, and I never had anyone that didn't help us. We like I said, it's really like a family reunion, as I like to couch it, when we all get together. Now, John, you own Landmart, M-A-R-T, hyphen as you have it in your name, Dean Land Realty Company, and you're in Leland, Mississippi. Where's that located, John?
Lou, it's in what we call the Delta, which is the northwestern part of the state. That's the alluvial plain where the great agricultural land is, and it's probably about 130 miles south of Memphis, maybe 90 miles north of Vicksburg, near the Mississippi River.
Okay. And that's pretty much some of the best farmland in the country, wouldn't you say?
And probably the world. And I say that, because it's about the Mississippi River. And as I was speaking to Rodney just earlier, the Mississippi River, when it gets to where we are, it is about 2 miles wide, and it is draining 41% of the United States at that point.
Wow.
So when the delta was formed, there were no levee systems, and it just it flooded every spring. And from that standpoint, over eons of time, it has built up nothing but topsoil.
Right.
In some cases, over 100 feet deep, and so you know, wow, you can imagine it's taken the best best soil from the Midwest and basically all over the heartland of the U.S. and deposited right here. So that in itself makes it for great soils. And then you also have a rechargeable aquifer from the Mississippi River that it keeps the water level at water table for irrigation at about 22 feet below the surface. So you have a very inexpensive way of groundwater irrigation, and the land is flat, and so you precision level that, and so it makes it perfect for irrigation and drainage. And you put all those things together with a good climate, and you've got the best, world's best situation.
They say three things sustain life for all of us. One of it is water, one out of his sun, and the other is 16 inches of soil worldwide, and that's what keeps us alive. So 20 inches, you guys could share that with some of the rest of the world, couldn't you? I'm just teasing.
Well, you really could, you know, but the fact that you've got so deep a top soil, then that enables that aquifer to recharge itself, and all of these things work together.
Yes, sir.
So it's a very, very unique situation, and also it's that way to a smaller degree on the other side of the Mississippi River in Arkansas and then northeast Louisiana. So that's what people know as the Delta. It's not the mouth of a river, but it's an alluvial plain.
Right, right. Which has been, like I said, built up over the years. I want to just give a little bit about your background. I mean, we could spend a whole show on the achievements, John, that you have, and thank you for all your service and dedication to our industry and to other organizations that you've lent your precious time to. But I met you in 2003 when I was president of our, at that time, it was Chapter 33, which was North Carolina and South Carolina chapter, as the chapter president in Washington at mid-year. And then you've served on our National Association of Realtors board for many years and been director and vice president of International Real Estate Federation. What is the International Real Estate Federation?
Well, that is the English term. The name is an acronym, FEOPSI, and that stands for a French acronym, which loosely translates into the International Real Estate Federation. It's headquartered in Paris, and they have country chapters in 62 different countries around the world, and they are just highly professional people that deal obviously in international real estate, because
right,
that's what it's all about, it's one of those things, another one of those organizations that you kind of gravitate to, and if you're dealing with a percentage of your business that's outside the U.S. or you're dealing with people from outside the U.S. that want to find properties here in the U.S. And so I was a member of that long before there was an international section, now global business alliance there with NAR, which I have continued to be in. But at that time, that was the only organization that, and NAR was a member of that and still is. And so it's grown out of that from an NAR standpoint. But again, FEOPSI probably is a nucleus of really serious international professionals in the real estate bit.
And that's for all types of real estate. That's not just for land. That's commercial.
Exactly.
That's,
right. Yeah, right. Yeah. So there aren't many in specifically in land in that area, as well as there even in NAR. But
right.
But if you got a minute, I can share with you little sidebar on that.
Please, it's your show.
And that's probably one of the reasons for not having many people involved in land internationally that do what we do.
So, please share that.
I had been to a World Congress there in Paris and gotten to know the Secretary General of the organization over there, and then about a month later, a Swiss individual called FEOPSI, and he was an investor, an industrialist, and had heard about farmland in the Mid-South and our area, and wondered if they knew of anyone in the South of the U.S. that dealt in such. And so he immediately, my name popped up. And so this individual, without calling me, they came to the U.S. on July the 4th. We were having a party in my backyard around our pool and everything. And this middle-aged couple came walking in. And obviously, we could tell that I didn't know who it was. Nobody else did. They came on in, and I spoke to them, and then they spoke back in a broken English, and I became more interested. And so we came over and sat down. Short story is that they came to buy farmland, and the next day we spent two or three days looking at stuff, and have sold them two or three properties over that short period of time, and then continued to, and they've been multi-buyers for last 20 years.
Wow, that was some party you had.
Yeah.
What were you serving?
I don't remember who the other guests were, but I do remember them very well.
Yeah, I'd say. They put money in the bank account.
They did.
That's a great to know that, and I'm sure you're a valuable person and lend your expertise to that, and well-respected, I'm sure, to be on the board. Then you were also director and vice president of the Mississippi World Trade Center from 2005 to 2020. I actually owned, with two other partners, a World Trade franchise, and we were going to build one in Wilmington, and found out in North Carolina, a guy in Charlotte had one, and our governor at the time had one with his cronies, and guess who won? It's in Raleigh. But that's fine. That's a heck of an organization, too, and does a lot of benefit for us. You were also president of the Mississippi Association of Realtors, which is quite an honor, NAR Global Business Alliance, member, chairman and member of the Mississippi Real Estate Commission since 2005. So you sitting on some high top chairs there, buddy.
Of course, the thing that you're leaving out is president of RLI, which is I consider that the most important of anything I have done.
That's right. No, I mentioned that the first time. That's how we met. But yes, sir. And you served us well. You took us through some hard times there and helped us get straightened out. You've received a lot of awards. One that I didn't put on here that you sent me an email, you won our Meeks Award a couple years ago, and that is the highest award in our organization for dedication and service to the Realtors Land Institute. And that is the highest honor anyone can get in our organization, and it's awarded annually and well received, John. I was there when you received it, and I think I patted you on the back. So, anyway, we're talking to John Dean, and this is Let's Talk Land. So, John, you are the founder and owner of Landmart, Inc., and then Dean Land Realty. So those are two companies, right, kind of work together?
Well, they really are. They were actually, I started Dean Land and Realty Company in 1980, and then as we veered more into to land and wanted that to be first and foremost, we incorporated another company, Landmart Inc., and then we've just merged the two basically for advertising purposes and everything. And so that's the way it's listed on publicity.
And on your website, you say that you're a full service real estate brokerage and management firm specializing in representation of buyers and sellers of investment grade farmland throughout the South, American South, and that's our topic today. We want to get into that during the show. You know, what is investment-grade farmland? And I assume timberland's part of that, too.
Well, I'll tell you, actually not. We really trying to focus on farm land and as opposed to timber land.
Gotcha.
However, I have sold, and our company has sold timber tracts, but we focus on where the row crop cultivatable land is, high quality land in these areas of Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Southwest Georgia, and that's where our primary area is. And if a property had some piece of farmland on part of it, fine, we would sell that. But we would prefer, and investors would prefer, having actually out of 1,000 acres, they would like to have 990 acres in row crop land.
Sure.
Because that's what makes the money for them.
Exactly. So you're over four generations. What is that? And I know you're John Dean Jr., right? Was your family, was your father or other people in your family involved? What's the four generations?
Right. Yeah. My grandfather, and some of his brothers actually, started things, and they came down to the Delta, probably in the 1890s and began buying up land and the towns were practically just nothing but farm headquarters basically at that time, because the Delta itself is not that old as far as a settled area, and really didn't start growing from a town standpoint till the railroads came in around the 1900s. So we've been here a long time.
Wow, that's quite a heritage. Your company's been leader in agricultural business and agricultural real estate, developing some of the largest plantations in the Mississippi Delta, and hopefully we'll get a little time maybe and talk about one of those. Today that Committed to Excellence continues as an associate broker and staff of our present companies focused on due diligence necessary in identifying and bringing to market properties which meet investment criteria. And what is investment criteria? What does that mean?
Going back to what is investment grade farmland, and I'll tell you the truth. 40 years ago, there was not an asset class in called this. I mean, the investment community really had not tuned into this, and so among other things, I actually farmed several thousand acres of some of our family farms and lands, and then another long story is after a certain period of time, I got a real estate license, not to sell real estate, but just to learn more about the business of real estate.
Right.
And wound up selling some farmland and also to some international buyers. And I said, you know, this could be fun. And so then at the end of that year, I leased my land out with the idea that if I could get the kind of return I was looking for, then I could do that and have the rental income and then sell farmland. So with that, I wanted to focus on high quality land that gave a good current return on investment plus capital appreciation. And so then those two together is obviously your total return.
Right.
So among other things, after the year I decided to lease my farmland out, I'd always had a commodities license, or rather commodities account, and the commodities broker, the securities broker said, look, if you ever decide to stop farming, I want you to be my commodities guy.
Huh.
And I thought, well, you know, I would kind of like that, so I tried it for a while, but got a general securities license and all. So during that period of time, I got to thinking about bonds and all, and the top of four grades of bonds, you know, what they are, and they're called investment grade. So then it was very easy to translate that to investors looking at the top four grades of land, farmland. You've got about eight general classifications of farmland.
Okay.
And the top four are called prime farmland. So that's there where I basically coined the name investment grade farmland, and everybody uses it now.
Yes, sir.
So,
good for you.
So it was easy to talk to people on Wall Street and other places, you know, about that as from that standpoint. And so you're looking, and they also are looking for a certain cap rate that they can get, and that's the way they go back to their boards with it.
Interesting. You know, not to be braggadocious, but, you know, in our code of ethics, which is over 100 years old now, we're one of the oldest, well, we're self-policing, as most, a lot of organizations are, but we're one of the oldest in the country. But in our code of ethics, Article 11, it basically, and I'll paraphrase it, says a realtor shouldn't be involved in a real estate transaction without proper training and education. And if not, they should bring aboard a person that is, and also explain who that person is and what their role is in the transaction. And it rattled off residential, property management, appraisal, international, but it commercial, but it never had the letter word land, which I brought to Gloria Bowman back in 2008 after taking the update code of ethics class. And on my way home, I called her and I said, how do we get land as a specialty? And, of course, that went to our professional standards group that monitors and keeps that document alive. And in 2010, NAR Board of Directors approved it, and land is now considered a specialty. So I hope I contributed something,
too. Well, I know it's an education process, and so many people, you know, probably 2% or less than 2% of people are actively involved on farms now in the U.S. And so most people, even that were or grew up on one, they're somewhere else, and so you don't really understand, the immense wealth and what goes on in farmland and also timber from that standpoint.
Right.
But it just doesn't come across their radar.
No, and thank God for the Realtors Land Institute and our 15 courses and our unprecedented curriculum and syllabus on all the different and people don't realize that. That's why I'm doing a talk show. When I first met with Rodney, he said, you want to do a 30-minute show or a one-hour show? I said, hell, I teach at one of our 15 classes. It's 16 hours. You know, I can't even get started in 30 minutes. So you're, I think, show number 57, and I haven't repeated anything twice. So, and there's more to talk about land. It's just so vast. There's so many tentacles to it and so many different types. And, thank God, you know.
And that's the key to the whole thing. You know, you can't be all things to all people or all things to all parts of real estate or whatever. And so if you can find that niche and zero in on that and do what you can to be the best in that particular area, then you can do well in your profession.
You're licensed in Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and, of course, I'm sure you work with our fellow RLI members and other special land specialists.
Right. We're licensed in Georgia as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And, so that's quite a territory to cover. But are there many of these type prime farms out there? I mean, is there thousands
of
them?
Well, see, that's the thing, and that's one of the reasons that, in land, you residential area or even commercial, you're kind of localized in your particular area, and you've got a lot of things to work. You know, in the investment grade farmland category, there's very little ever on the market because it is desirable, and people that have it don't want to let it go.
Sure.
And then you've got the situations of capital gains and things that you do, and you know, of course we. If we didn't have 1031 exchanges, we probably wouldn't have a profession either. But at any rate, for example, over half of what our company ever sells never comes to the market, public market, because we know the international, the institutional, and other potential individual buyers that would be looking for something like that, and so you talk about a sizable investment to begin with. But do I have a 1,000-acre farm that I'm trying to sell right now? No. If I did, I would have sold it or could sell it by Sunday. So it's that type thing. We have people that are constantly dealing with people that are, you know, a state situations or others that are in some form of estate planning that may want to divest something, and from that standpoint, and if they do, if it fits those categories, and if we can get it listed at a price that would make sense from an investor standpoint or another individual farmer standpoint, where they can show a return that they want to on the investment, then we can sell it easily.
So just in part of my research, if I may, and I forgot where I found this, but it said farmland real estate is not a bubble. The land values are doing what they do over time, appreciating. The first step to understand why buying and owning quality farmland for crop production and recreation is a good investment is to understand some of the fundamentals which drive the market for those assets. Just buying some agricultural land won't be a good investment, but investing in agricultural business could be a great investment. While you cannot deduct the purchase price from farmland on your taxes, plenty of other tax deductions are associated with farmland. Interest paid on loans purchased farmland is deductible, the purchasing cost. Interest paid on loans to do any improvements to the land are also deductible. Of course, land is the oldest investment class in existing, producing enormous wealth over generations. We think the United States farmland represents an attractive long-term investment, providing significant relative capital preservation during the times of economic turmoil. And, you know, I'm not quite 30 years, but land prices, you know, following the USDA annual report for pasture land and farmland, seeing the pluses and minuses and values, you know, our land values have actually increased fairly consistently, you know, 3 to maybe 6%, depending on where you are and what type of land it is, up until 2014 when we had the kind of crash in the international commodities. And that's when we saw land prices, even in my area here, drop, which it never had before, which is now, quite frankly, rebounded. Did you see that with the prime land investments? Did that affect the prices at that time?
Farmland has, you know, in the last 15 years, has kind of come into a golden era, let's say, and some of the key things that have caused all of this, say the last 15, 20 years, is technology and great advances in genetics and the genetic engineering, things like that. So you have all of that, and that's gotten the attention of all types of investors. And so, you know, you go back 20, 30, 40 years ago, farmland's always been reasonably profitable, but not, you know, just marginally so. But then you get all of these things together, and you come to a point that once in a while you have a perfect storm, and you know, that kind of hit its crescendo maybe around 2011 or so, and you know, where you had really high commodity prices, you had great yields, you had, you know, all the other economic factors that were favorable. And then you, so obviously that caused farmland rents to escalate at a fast clip as well. That caught the attention of numerous new institutional buyers, hedge funds. We would have a new hedge fund that would be calling us probably a new one, you know, about every month, thinking there was all this land out there that could be bought, and they had $100 million to invest and stuff. But what they didn't understand is that there never was much on the market, and then it was even less, you know, from that standpoint. So, anyway, land.
John, I'm going to interrupt. This is John Dean. Let's talk land. So, you know, we talked about 2011. We saw a decrease, and then pick up from there, John.
Okay, well, about 2011 was really a kind of a high point when everything came together, and then commodity prices began began falling for various reasons, and then it was followed by a year or two of yields that primarily in the Corn Belt and all that were off, and so that caused those prices to start dropping maybe as much in places up there at 10% a year. Then they kind of leveled out. We never did see in the Mid South prices fall, but what they did, the increase kind of leveled off, and so we then from about about 16, they kind of leveled off then at about in the last couple of years, and they've been maybe about a 1% increase a year or so, but it's going to kind of hold at that level, but there's still nothing on the market for sale. And so if someone really, really wanted to buy something, they would have to be satisfied with a cap rate that would be, you know, in the 3.5% range or something like that on a current return or less, probably to try to get a price that would work. I mean, good quality farmland here is going to be somewhere in the $6,500 range per acre.
Okay.
The high point here was actually about July of last year at $8,200 an acre. So that was a little bit of an outlier. That's not to say that all the stuff is worth that, but the fact is that it's just not on the market.
Right. Supply and demand.
So
one of my things that I found is saying like $10,000 invested in quality farmland in 1990 would be worth over $187,000 today. You know, it's quite significant. My family, great-grandfather and grandfather, bought 18 farms here in Surry County, North Carolina, between 1909 and 1929, non-contiguous but in the immediate area. And the last tract my grandfather bought was a wooded tract. It was 300 acres on one of our rivers, and he paid $3,500 for it, which was about $11.77 an acre. Today, I could put that on the market probably around $5,000 an acre, which is $1.5 million. And if you go back to 29 to this date, you're looking at pretty solid 6% appreciation on the property, and the timber's been cut twice during that period of time. And we have land use tax reduction programs here in our counties, so they reduce the taxable asset and a lower tax rate. And I think last time I checked, the taxes on it annually was $280 a year. So what's wrong with that picture?
Well, there's very little wrong with it, obviously. You know, and even when I look more at the farmland area, there's an organization of those institutions that invest in farmland called the National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries on Nay Creek, and they keep an index of sales and all, and they've been following that for about the past 20 years, and actually more than that, but I've been more familiar with it for the past 20, but when they go back and compare that with all other types of investments that any type of institution would want to invest in, it beats everything.
Yeah.
All equities, bonds, you know, whatever, and the overall average return has probably been, you know, somewhere 12% or so, or something like that. You know, in that period of time. So it, you know, and what that means is the current return that you're getting each year, whether it be from farmland rents or incomes or plus the capital appreciation, and the way these institutions would do it, they choose to lease their lands out, and then they'll have an appraiser that comes in about every year and appraises that land, and based on that, then they will take the combined total of that, and that's what they keep in their records to come up with it, with this this data.
Yeah, one of my research said over the past 2 years, institutional investments in the U.S. farmland topped $2 billion, according to II Searches. I guess that's a data search for organization for institutional investors. Said the trend seems to be continuing in August. TIAA-CREF.
TIAA-CREF, right.
What's that acronym?
They are the big boys among the institutional investors by far.
Said they raised $3 billion in second global farmland investment partnership. And then institutions, however, still own less than 1% of the $2.4 trillion in U.S. farmland market. So is that because of the yields, the investment formula, or is that just why isn't there more?
Wait, I'm not sure. Why isn't there more? What? I'm not.
Well,
sure
it just says institutions still own less than 1% of a $2.4 trillion farmland market. My question.
Well,
is,
because all right, so you know, fortunately, that you know, we have a healthy mix of ownership in farmland, and there's a whole lot of individual landowners, farmers that own it, and they have actually been over the past 15 years or so even more aggressive than the institutional buyers in buying. In other words, a lot of times we'll have an offer back when we did have several properties that we, you know, had on the market and all, you know, institutional buyer would make its offer, and then an individual buyer would in more than half the time would outbid them on that. So, you know, it's not a situation to where a landowner will just turn it over. You know, it's going to take the high bid, and in most cases, institutional buyers are more conservative, you know, and they're buying it for their pension funds, and that, you know, so they have their parameters they have to go by.
Sure.
And individual buyers or farmers know that this high quality farmland is so rare that they better jump out there if they possibly can and take it. So they will be, in a lot of cases, be a little bit more aggressive in buying than an institution.
Interesting. Average rent in the U.S. farmland over the past 16 years rose to about 5%. I didn't get a date on it. I tried to pull the most current stuff I could. It was about $141 per acre in 2014, according to U.S. Department of Agriculture. What are you seeing in the properties that you guys?
Well, I mean, you know, again, the USDA is averaging everything.
Right.
You know, so you know when you average put everything in a basket, then it that doesn't mean a whole lot other than the fact that maybe going up some. But
right.
But you've got all different qualities of land. You know, this type of land we're talking about would probably conservatively run it like at 225 to 250 or something like that, and that, however, is down a little bit from where its high point around 2012 or so, where some land that was now leasing at 250 or so, more or less, would have been bringing $300 an acre. So it's down a little bit, but the selling price has not gone down because, you know, again, it's in strong hands, and people are just saying, well, it's that, you know, commodity prices will come back up, and therefore farmland leases will come back up, and so if you want it, you take it at my price, or I'm not selling.
Right. You know, they just passed the farmland bill recently. How does that affect the product you're involved in?
Well, you know, of course, obviously, passing a farm bill every 4 years without an extension is what you really want, and you want early passage of a farm bill because that has a very stabilizing effect on the whole was an improvement somewhat over the previous farm bill. Not a whole lot, but at least it was an improvement. It serves more as a safety net, which farmers really need that. They need an improvement in their crop insurance, for example. It put more money into agricultural research, which is very important. You don't realize that right immediately, but if you cut back on that, you start seeing the bad results 15, 20 years down the road.
Right.
For example, then other things it was a help for cotton, which as a commodity had been dealt a bad blow in the previous farm bill because of some very poor negotiation that was done with the World Trade Organization, and they sided in favor of Brazil, which caused the United States just to back off and classify cotton under the previous bill, farm bill, as not one of the covered commodities like corn, soybeans,
right.
Rice, things like that.
I remember that.
So now all that's back in like it was, and that's a positive.
Very positive.
So for all it's a decent farm bill that people can work with. You you're so tied to worldwide commodities and trade wars and things like that kind of got things a little bit more depressed right now than they should be.
I had our good friend Bob Turner on, the week after that was passed, and of course he was one of our representatives for the Realtors Land Institute with the government affairs and all the lobbyists and all the experts and input of where that bill was and what it should be. And it was quite a show. You can go back and listen to it. And, what a great gift Bob Turner is. God bless him.
He is
a tremendous asset for our organization. And like many others, it's just amazing how many quality people we have in the Realtors Land Institute. And like yourself, John, we're very proud of you and what you do. You really make a great contribution to our organization and to others that you reach out to. Thank you.
And mighty kind to say that.
Farmland REITs, do you see much of that in what you're doing? Real Estate Investment Trust?
Well, yeah. I mean, because that comes under the category of institutional buyers. And,
right.
The way these things work, in fact, a number of them, we've sold farms and properties to several of these REITs that putting together their portfolios and there are several of them out there.
Is that kind of like where the majority comes, percentage-wise? What
is that? What now?
Is that like a good percentage? What percentage are REIT in investments for what you're doing?
Well, of course, all right. REITs would probably not be there are some, but then there where you see most of them are just directly. They were set up, let's say, a particular company. I'll give you an example, like Hancock Agricultural Investment Group. All right, okay, so I'm just using them as an example.
Yeah, sure, there are many.
But there would be many like that. But what they will do, they'll go out and they will bid on certain packages that some particular public employees retirement system in some state or whatever, would have. Let's say they've got $500 million they want to put in farmland. All right, so several of these companies will bid on them, and then Hancock may not want to put all of that with that particular group, but there might be a REIT that's getting started somewhere, and they might put $50 million into that one, or something like that, or some other group. So it kind of gets spread around, but a REIT, there's some that are getting started like that, and it probably makes sense, just like it does in any other type of commercial real estate. That the thing is, it's just you don't have property, a product on the market in order to make these things happen. And it's hard to find properties to fill the money that's waiting out there to buy farmland.
Right.
I mean, there's just I know of three or four right now in New York and areas that've got hundreds of millions that want to buy farmland. It's just not out there to be bought right now at where they want to buy it.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about foreign investors. Legally, foreigners are allowed to buy land anywhere they want in the United States. However, foreign individual owns U.S. real property and a foreign corporation individual will not be subject to estate tax that property because the shares of the foreign corporation are considered non-U.S. Used assets for U.S. estate tax purposes, saying that the USDA data foreign ownership of American farmland has doubled to about 27.3 million acres, which is slightly larger than the entire state of Tennessee. Of that, 21.5% is cropland. The rest is forestry and pasture land. While it represents about 2% of total farmland, the value of foreign ownership in the United States farmland soared from $17.4 billion in today's dollars to about $42.7 billion during the same period of time, of course, to the United States Department of Agriculture. How many of your investors are foreign investors, John?
Well, over the, you know, I'd say over the past 25 years, you know, some years we probably 20-25% of our, you know, gross commissions would come from international buyers or international sellers. We sold a property last year. We do have three right now international owners that we've sold property to, and we manage the property for them, and those are ongoing situations. One of these is considering possibly selling if you know he can get a price. Probably, you know, 15% higher where he could probably sell it, but he probably would if that situation, because the exchange rate is very favorable to sell in the United States, not to buy, you know, so that we've got a strong dollar over here. So all these things enter in, and that's slowing the international buyers from that standpoint. But people, individuals buy, whether they're in, and most of ours are in Switzerland and Germany now. We've had a couple of clients from Portugal, Spain, Great Britain, and Japan won. But most of them are buy for the same reasons that a wealthy individual in the United States would. They're looking for a return. They're looking for safety. And something that will appreciate over time and they can pass on.
Right. The bipartisan bill named the Food Security and National Security Act of 2017 was introduced to attempt to require more information for a place more restrictions on any deal that might potentially place agricultural land in the hands of foreign nations. It's currently bouncing around the Senate. Do you know anything about that and where it is?
Well, you know, a lot of this stuff's kind of started in, been going on back and forth from the Corn Belt areas, and probably there are a few states that are still more restrictive than others, Iowa being one, but it never was the scare that people thought it was going to be anyway. And,
right.
And you know, if an individual from, and we've had several, but we've actually sold about as much land that they have bought, different ones over the time. So it we've got maybe about a net 1% increase of what we actually sold between buying and selling from international standpoint over 10 years. But what they will do is set up, for example, in our state, they would set up a domestic corporation. And so there's some that say, well, gosh, you can't tell who owns it? Well, you can, you know, I mean, because the USDA requires that they report the names of and addresses of people that make up that particular domestic corporation. So
right.
you have to drill back down a little bit, but you can find out that they might live in Greenwich in Switzerland, for example. But it doesn't say that because it's got a domestic address in the U.S. You know, so it's not the problem that some people try to make it be.
Okay, are there any problems that we should recognize on this show today?
Are any what?
Are there any problems we should recognize on this show today that you see or foresee?
Any problems in international ownership?
Yeah, is there anything you see in the future that's going to affect what we're doing in investment grade real estate, land, farms?
You know, I think if there were a way to level the table somewhat in terms of international markets and subsidies or lack thereof in certain countries over one over another, and if we could just cut these duties and tariffs, equalize them somewhat, and just make the table level, then the market would stabilize a whole lot more than they are.
Right. Just want to give a little statistics right here on Mississippi agriculture, forestry, and natural resources. There's 35,800 farms. There's 10.7 million acres in farmland, 26.75 billion in value of farmlands and buildings, 19.7 million acres of forest land, 14,000 miles of streams, 640,000 acres of ponds and lakes. There's six enterprises: poultry, eggs, forestry, soybeans, cotton, corn, cattle, and calves. 2018 farm gate value of ag and forestry products, including government permits, was $7.72 billion. Value of MS Mississippi economy by ag and forestry products was $16.75 billion, and research and development expenditures for Mississippi State University. What a great school that is! I got one of my cousins that's got two doctorate degrees from there, been part of their
great
research with some of the boll weevil bugs or some of the bugs down there. I don't know. Is around $109 million. There's 3,596 students enrolled at the Ag College at Mississippi State University in fall of 2018, and there's 192,956 FAR Bureau members. So congratulations on your state. You guys are doing a great job down there.
Well, you've got a lot of statistics right at hand, obviously, and I'm not going to refute any of them. Apparently, they must be pretty well up to date. But
I didn't make them up, John. Google, blame them.
Yeah, well, I know.
But with about 3-4 minutes here, what is it that we haven't talked about that you feel we need to add to your show, John?
Well, that's a loaded question.
It is. I'll see you in the bar after the show.
Why don't you ask me some questions that maybe you have that I have not covered that you hope that I would have?
Well, some of the guests that I've had on, artificial intelligence, real estate, paperless transactions, the new technologies, Farm Finder. I just had him on, Steve Boswell, here last week, second show. They're now in like 12 states where they can go in and tell you everything that's for sale, every auction, sales, soils, crops, yields. The technology, not only from statistical analyzation data, putting it all together, but the technology of people, equipment driven by GPS satellites, non-human and pesticides and herbicides and all this stuff. I mean, we've got a lot more people coming on this planet, and with only 16% of the land, total land, in the world is agriculture or suitable for agriculture, and of course we're losing that over the years. what do you see in the future? I mean, we're kind of finishing our years on this world, but for the younger generation, and how do we get more younger, the younger kids involved in land and farming, in your opinion?
Well, you actually touched on it, and I mentioned it earlier. I said, you know, one of the things that kind of led to a golden era of agriculture is it's been technology and great improvements in genetics and all of these areas, because you know, now agriculture, agribusiness has become a cool thing, and when you look at it from that standpoint, it's attracting students. That's one of the things that's really causing growth in these large agricultural schools and colleges. Is that particular area? You know, the traditional areas of which you need them, ag economics and the statistical side of it and everything like that, is kind of just the same old, you know, but you've got to have that. But when you start looking at all of the technological advances and all that as they're being now applied and fielded in agriculture, then that's spurring this growth, and not only here, but then, you know, worldwide as well.
One just real quick thing with about a minute to go here, John. ATF's Farmland Information Center on transfers of ownership saying that they're projecting ownership of about 40% of the 48 states, 991 million farm and ranch acres will change hands from 2015 to 2035. So, you know, hopefully that's the younger generations who will continue highest and best use and good practice and keep our country healthy and help us feed the world population. John, how did they get in touch with you? You're the man to go to on this investment grade farms. I can tell you that right now. So if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Well, the easiest way then would be my email, which is jdean@deanlandmart.com, or a cell phone, 662-822-3877, or go to my website, and there's a place for putting in contact on things from that standpoint as well.
Okay. Say your website again for me.
www.deanlandmart.com.
John, you've been a fabulous guest today. I've been wanting you on the show since I started this. I want to have you back on again and help me find some of your buddies out there on topics and subjects of land you can co-host with me on the next show.
Well, be glad to. And I'm sorry that I get long-winded on things. If I could see your hand raising and say you've got 30 seconds, I'd know when to stop, you know. But at any rate, it's been fun, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, John, for joining us today. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any guests or topics you'd like to suggest, we'd appreciate them. All questions are welcome, and all of our guests will be emailed with your questions or concerns. They're on my website, which is www.letstalkland.net. We're also on Podbeam, Spotify, Facebook, YouTube. My email is lou@mylandpro.com. My cell phone number is 336-669-1405. Rodney, how do they get in touch with us here at the station?
Well, they can go to our website, go to WKTE1090.com and email us there. And also they can download the Simple Radio app anywhere in the world and hear us and hear your show every Saturday morning at 9 o'clock.
9 to 10. Now, WKTE, we're beach music and oldies, right?
That's
five
right.
5 years in a row.
5 years in a row. Top radio station on the East Coast there.
That's pretty, pretty admirable.
Yes.
But thank you guys for allowing me to put on this show, and we'll see you next week.